Today is Monday, October 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. military forces crossed the border into Iraq Monday after pulling out of northeastern Syria.
The current game plan is for those forces to reposition into western Iraq.
Also ahead, what's next for Britain and the EU, and the latest Brexit deal? And clashes continue in Hong Kong despite a mask ban. Those stories and more are all coming up next on today's International Edition. United States troops have crossed into Iraq from Syria through the Shahela border crossing in the northern province of Duhok. U.S. troops withdrew from their largest base in northern Syria on Sunday. U.S. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper said American forces leaving Syria would be deployed elsewhere.
The current game plan is for those forces to reposition into western Iraq. The ones coming out, right? That original 1,000.
Esper said more than 700 U.S. troops would be moved into Iraq and not come home, as U.S. President Donald Trump had tweeted they would, and would carry out anti-terrorist operations against the Islamic State group. Joining us now on the phone is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what can you tell us about where U.S. troops are going and what their roles will be?
Well, we know right now that the majority of the U.S. forces in northeast Syria are actually still there. We talk about a withdrawal, but this is going to take weeks, Secretary Esper says. And so we know that so far we've seen a convoy that has made it into western Iraq. We also know that some have been withdrawing via helicopters and via fixed-wing aircraft, but there are plenty still there. I know that the United States forces have pulled out of some areas of Kobani, but the Kobani landing zone, our primary way inside and outside of Syria, that's still open and that's still being utilized to get forces out and also to get equipment that we need out. We also know a little further south, there are some U.S. troops paired with the Syrian Democratic Forces that are basically monitoring the oil fields to make sure that Islamic State fighters don't try to recapture these oil fields and start using the revenue to build their forces back again. And then when you go further south, we know that there are U.S. forces that are not going to be leaving the Al-Tanf base down in the south because the United States feels that even while the rest of the U.S. forces are withdrawing, this base needs to stay to fight Islamic State and also to prevent Iran from kind of going in and having more malign influence in that region.
The ceasefire that was brokered by U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that 120 hours is coming to a close rapidly. What can you tell us about the status of that endeavor?
Well, it's a very complicated endeavor because depending on who you talk to, the ceasefire means totally different things. We hear from Turkish officials that they want to extend that area beyond the 125 kilometers of the border that the U.S. forces and the Kurdish forces understand that that ceasefire is going to be a part of. So Turkey had initially agreed with the United States to have like a rectangle of 125 kilometers across, 30 kilometers down into Syria. Syrian Democratic Forces, the commander just told VOA today that their forces have pulled out of the two major cities in that little rectangle. Tal Abyad is one of them and Ras Al Ain is the other one. But Turkey wants to extend it further. And if that's the case, then there could be a lot of fighting starting Tuesday.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but I want to get your information on this as well, because Secretary Esper was in Afghanistan talking about Taliban talks. What can you share with us about those discussions?
He says that those are the primary means to ending the fighting in Afghanistan. He said that the United States could pull down to 8,600 forces if they wanted to and still maintain their counterterrorism capabilities, but he wouldn't get into the details on how that would affect the training and partnering that we're doing with the Afghans in the fight against the Taliban. General Miller also added to that. He said that the U.S. is always looking at its force posture, and they'd actually pulled out about 2,000 forces over the course of the year, U.S. troops from Afghanistan, without anybody even noticing this year.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
The Syrian Democratic Forces' Ilham Ahmed is currently in Washington. She told VOA's Kurdish service that she came to Washington to meet government officials, members of the Congress, and to inform the American public about the difficult situation Kurds were put in after President Trump's decision to withdraw troops from northeastern Syria. Ahmed said Turkey is willing to carry out ethnic cleansing by expelling the Kurds from their ancestral lands and bringing Arab refugees in Turkey to settle the Kurdish homes. She also said that Christian and Yazidi minorities are also in great danger because Turkey-backed jihadist groups are targeting them. Ahmed will try to appeal to President Trump and to U.S. public opinion to leave American forces in northern Syria and prevent the slaughter of the people there. She said the danger of the Islamic State militants is still in the region and has become emboldened with Turkey's operation to carry out more attacks. Ahmed called the reemergence of the group a threat for everyone. In Chile, authorities are scrambling to clear wreckage and reopen public transportation after protests Sunday turned violent. Several people were killed after a supermarket in the Chilean capital of Santiago was set alight by demonstrators, while many flights into the city's airport were suspended as crew members could not get to work, according to the city's governor. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy has more.
Santiago and other Chilean cities have been engulfed by several days of rioting. Protests over an increase in public transport costs have prompted President Sebastián Piñera to declare a state of emergency. Flights operated by Chile's biggest airlines, LATAM, and another, Sky Airline, were suspended or delayed on Sunday morning. A curfew, a public transport shutdown, and continued rioting left flight crews struggling to get to work. Walmart Chile confirmed that it would close its stores across the country after 60 were damaged in the unrest.
That was Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy. UN Human Rights official Michelle Bachelet said former president, who is a former president of Chile, called for independent investigations into deaths in the weekend protest there, citing disturbing allegations of excessive use of force by security forces. Bachelet says that there are at least 8 people who have died and 44 injured, 9 of them seriously. She called for an immediate dialogue and a halt to inflammatory rhetoric. Protesters closed major roads around Lebanon ahead of an emergency cabinet meeting Monday as politicians scrambled to put together a rescue plan for the country's crumbling economy and stem 5 days of mass anti-government protests. At least 55 elephants have starved to death in the past 2 months in Zimbabwe's biggest national park as a serious drought forces animals to stray into nearby communities in search of food, water, according to authorities. Other animals, such as lions, at the Hwange National Park have also been affected. U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said the U.S. president's Phase 1 trade deal between the United States and China does not need to be finalized next month. Mr. Ross said on the Fox Business Network, it's more critical that it be a proper deal than when it exactly occurs. Britain's parliamentary speaker, John Bercow, told the government on Monday it would not again try to get a vote on Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Brexit deal because it was posing the same question to the parliament twice.
In summary, today's motion is in substance the same as Saturday's motion, and the House has decided the matter. Today's circumstances are in substance the same as Saturday's circumstances. My ruling is therefore that the motion will not be debated today, as it would be repetitive and disorderly to do so.
On Saturday, the House of Commons voted down Prime Minister Johnson's Brexit deal 322-306. Today, a lawmaker from the Northern Irish Democratic Unionist Party said it would not support a possible amendment that would put the United Kingdom in a customs union with the EU. The Sunday Times also reported that the EU will delay Brexit until February 2020 if Johnson is unable to get his deal past Parliament this week. Joining us now on the phone is Henry Ridgewell with the latest. Henry, welcome.
Great to be with you, Steve.
So this is very uncharted territory. Where are things going from here if there can't be a vote to pass this next deal?
Yes, again, uncharted territory in British politics. it's again very unclear where this goes. In Boris Johnson's plan, we would have voted on the withdrawal agreement on Saturday, and that would have been passed. The government would have had momentum, and all things considered, then Brexit would have happened on October the 31st. As it is, it's effectively parliamentary procedure yet again that has held him up. Basically, the parliament has ruled that the piece of legislation that would put that withdrawal agreement into British law must be passed before MPs approve the actual withdrawal agreement that was signed with the EU itself. All that means is that they have plenty more chances to amend the legislation, to stick roadblocks in the way of Boris Johnson, to request things like another referendum or a customs union with the European Union, grand changes to this withdrawal agreement. And given we've got just 10 days until that Brexit deadline, the chances really of the Prime Minister meeting that seem to be getting slimmer by the day.
So what's happening over in Brussels? Because there was some reports out that there may be a temporary extension to allow the logistics of this bill being passed to postpone things to, say, February 2020.
Yes, there's various ideas. That is the latest one during the round in Brussels. They certainly don't want a very long extension, I think. Most of them just want to get Brexit done. But if they see that there are procedures in Britain that must be followed to get this done, I think most leaders there will say, well, OK, a few weeks, a few months, that will be OK. I think what they will have more reservations about is that if there is a whole-scale change of approach in Britain, if, for example, Boris Johnson is not able to pass the withdrawal agreement or the withdrawal agreement bill, and we're going round in circles, there may well be European leaders, in particular people like President Macron of France, who will say, we've been doing this for 3 years now, and somewhere you've got to draw a line, and this is it. Even if, at the last minute, the EU does then give an extension, just to give the impression that it won't, might focus minds of MPs in London, and then they might get their act together and pass some kind of withdrawal deal. But what we can say is that everything's still to play for. With just 10 days to go, we could still have a general election, we could still have a second referendum. We just don't know what's going to happen with this withdrawal agreement that was signed last week to much fanfare in Brussels.
As things develop, we'll be sure to call you once more. Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thank you so much for your time.
Good to be with you.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The U.S. space agency, NASA, marked a major milestone when, for the first time, an all-woman team walked in space on Friday, October 18, 2019. NASA astronauts and ISS Expedition 61 flight engineers Christina Koch and Jessica Meir began their extravehicular activity, or EVA, at 11:38 Universal Time. The first woman to walk in space was Soviet cosmonaut Svetlana Savitskaya when she performed a spacewalk outside the Salyut 7 spacecraft in July 1984. A number of women have performed EVAs in the years since, but they were teamed up with male astronauts. During their successful 7-hour and 17-minute EVA, the astronauts replaced a failed power charging component and performed other tasks, such as installing supports that will hold a future payload platform for the European Space Agency. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Tens of thousands of protesters marched in Hong Kong on Sunday, marking the 20th straight weekend of demonstrations against what they see as Beijing's attempts to control the city. The latest protest was met with strong opposition by police, who used water cannons and tear gas on the demonstrators. Earlier today, I spoke with VOA's Anita Powell as Chief Executive Carrie Lam left to attend Emperor Naruhito's enthronement ceremony in Japan. Anita, we have now hit 20 weeks of protests in Hong Kong since the extradition bill was first introduced that sparked the protests. That, of course, has since been withdrawn. But this weekend saw another round of violent clashes between protesters and authorities. You were out there. What exactly did you see?
This weekend, we did see clashes between police and protesters. Police deploying water cannon and tear gas with almost alarming frequency. Protesters who were gathered in sort of the Mong Kok Kowloon shopping area of Hong Kong is on the mainland part of Hong Kong, not on the island. There were tens of thousands of people who gathered to this protest, many ages, from children to the elderly, and the police took a very firm line against the protesters. From talking to people today in the aftermath, I think that's only strengthened their resolve.
Chief Executive Carrie Lam issued an apology today for some of the use of the water cannons in and around a mosque in Kowloon. How has the community received that?
Well, the head of the Indian Association here, Cindy, does not accept her apology. And what's notable about this particular mosque, it's been on the protest path for a few weeks now. So everybody knows where it is. And on Sunday, we had protesters standing outside the mosque and saying, we will protect the people in this mosque. And so it's hard to believe that the police could say that they did not know that the mosque was there, or they did not know what it represented. And so that might be the reason for the apology, because everybody knew it was there, and everybody knew that it might be a target. Protesters had said that they were not going to do anything to interfere with the mosque because they have respect for all of Hong Kong's residents, which include about 1% of the residents are South Asian in origin, which is the bulk of our Muslim population here in this city.
These protests are coming after Carrie Lam instituted this mask ban. Has that seemed to have any kind of effect on who's coming out or what they're wearing while they're protesting?
No, people are wearing masks with comfort and ease and without any concern for the fact that it is technically now illegal. Because, of course, going back a step, it was illegal for people to congregate in the numbers in which they congregated on the streets on Sunday, and they did it anyway. So there seems to be, on the side of the protesters, a disregard.
Anita Powell's in Hong Kong. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The United States and South Korea must produce new solutions for the current standoff on the Korean Peninsula. That's according to a senior North Korean military official. The same official also warned that hostile policies towards Pyongyang would lead to serious consequences. Earlier, I spoke with Harry Kazianis, senior director of Korea Studies at the Center for the National Interest. Harry, I want to ask you, in your opinion, what is the correct lens into which to view this latest Korean statement about the status of events on the Korean Peninsula, taking into consideration the recent photo shoot by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un on the top of Mount Baekdu?
I think it's very simple. The clock is ticking. I think the North Koreans are making it very clear through all different sorts of statements over the last 2 to 3 months that they're getting very impatient with the United States. I think they were under the assumption that the United States was going to offer some sort of deal, that the United States was going to offer some sort of step-by-step approach, which is what the North Koreans have been asking for a long time. And it seems pretty clear that either the United States is unwilling, unable, or just locked into impeachment chaos in Washington now.
Is it more than just that? Because the impeachment is one thing, but this is also an election cycle. And there's also the business going on in the Middle East with Syria and Turkey and the Islamic State group.
You're 100% right. So what ends up happening is what happens many times in Northeast Asia, that the problems with North Korea drop to number 5 or number 6 on Washington's radar. And that's when we have a history of North Korea getting a little antsy and deciding to raise the temperature a little bit. That's why I think when the clock strikes midnight on December 31st and we go into 2020, we are going to be back to a time of tension. I think there's no doubt about it at this point.
Well, you bring up New Year's Day because that is the time when Kim Jong-un gives essentially his policy speech, so to speak, his New Year's address. And we go back in, even, you know, this year, the 2019, and what he laid out and his goals for discussions and disarmament and denuclearization. Should we put more weight onto what is printed on the 2020 January 1st address?
Absolutely, because the North Koreans, it seems like every single time he makes that speech, he literally tells us what he is going to do. A lot of us that study Korea always, you know, unravel in the mystery of North Korea, and a lot of times there is a lot of things that they do that we don't understand, but the North Koreans make it very clear where they're headed. They told us back in 2017 that they were going to test ICBMs. Guess what? They did it. And there's a whole litany of things that you could go back to in these speeches that show that they're going to, they always try to, what they say they try to do. And I think in 2020, it's going to be no exception. I think what Kim is going to tell us is that he is turning the page with the United States and that his new way is probably going to be a combination of sanctions busting, allying with China and Russia, probably doing tests of more provocative weapons going into the spring, perhaps even an ICBM test. And then it's going to really be important for Washington to figure out how they're going to respond. And I don't think anybody really knows what the Trump administration is going to do, considering some of his actions in Syria recently.
Harry Kazianis is the Senior Director of Korea Studies at the Center for the National Interest. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thanks for having me.
Australia's biggest newspapers have blacked out their front pages to protest against legislation that restricts press freedoms. Phil Mercer reports editors have argued the media is subject to a regime of intense government secrecy and the threat of criminal charges for journalists for doing their job.
The unprecedented front page protest is meant to put pressure on the Australian government to exempt reporters from laws restricting access to sensitive information. In June, the police raided the headquarters of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation and the home of a newspaper editor on suspicion of receiving national secrets. The ABC said the raid on its office was in relation to 2017 stories about accusations of misconduct by the Australian military in Afghanistan. Richard Baker is a journalist at the Age newspaper in Melbourne.
It's really the media standing up on behalf of the people we try to serve, which is the public, to say, hey, we work in this space so that the public are informed and can make decisions about, you know, really important stuff that government does in their name. And when we can't do that, we feel like we're failing.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says the media must respect the law.
We'll always believe in the freedom of the press. It's an important part of our freedoms as a liberal democracy. Also believe in the rule of law and that no one is above it, including me or anyone else, any journalist or anyone else.
There have been long-standing tensions between the media and the Australian government. In December, a court order prevented the press reporting that the former Vatican treasurer, Cardinal George Pell, had been found guilty on child sex abuse charges. Prosecutors are now seeking fines and jail sentences for 36 Australian journalists and publishers for their coverage of the trial. Australian media organisations argue that press freedoms have been slowly eroded by more counter-terrorism and security laws that have been passed since the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the United States. The government asked a parliamentary committee to investigate the impact of Australian law enforcement and intelligence agencies on press freedom. The committee will report its conclusions next month. Reporting for VOA in Sydney, I'm Phil Mercer.
Canadians vote on Monday to determine whether Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who swept into office 4 years ago as a charismatic figure, will remain in power after two major scandals. Reuters reporter Zachary Goldman.
I am very excited and confident about the choice Canadians are making.
Trudeau's 4 years in office have been dogged by criticism of his handling of a corruption case and his image tarnished after pictures emerged of him wearing black and brown-faced makeup more than two decades ago. Polls show Trudeau's Liberal Party in a neck-and-neck race with the opposition Conservatives, led by Andrew Scheer.
Justin Trudeau has divided Canadians, he's divided provinces, he's failed to stand up for the types of big ideas, the big projects that can bring this country together.
That's awesome.
In his bid to unseat Trudeau, Scheer is also promising to balance the federal budget and eliminate a carbon tax on fossil fuels. If no party wins an outright majority of seats in Parliament, Trudeau may have the chance to stay in office, but with a minority government. That may leave him reliant on the support of the left-wing New Democratic Party. And NDP leader Jagmeet Singh has excoriated Trudeau and the Liberals for failing to live up to progressive promises.
Unlike Conservatives, they're going to cut services, and unlike Mr. Trudeau, who likes to say nice words but doesn't deliver on them, New Democrats will fight for you for all the things that you need in your life to make your life better.
Hi, Jagmeet, I voted for you!
Singh could play kingmaker after votes are cast.
And that was Reuters reporter Zachary Goldman. And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, engineer, John Dryden, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for listening and joining us today. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.